I want to be able to see your faces. I also want to be able to read this, what's here in my notes. We'll work it out. This is some time ago. This would have been like maybe 2-3 years ago. Maybe two. Over 2 years ago. I was with a yogi who was talking about her aspirations for practice, aspirations for her life. And when she spoke about them, it was as if her aspirations and her intention to live into her aspirations for life and her practice filled her with just a lot of dignity. It was very powerful to see. Actually, I want a little more light because I want to be able to see you. Ooh, but then you really see me. That's not enough. There's no in between.
No.
Oh.
You'll get used to the talk one. I'm sure you'll be fine.
Aspirations for life, aspirations for practice. Her name's Roberta. Beautiful, beautiful. She was filled with so much. It's as if calling on her aspirations in that moment filled her. She was regal. She was beautiful. And as you can tell, it left a mark on my heart. And I think a lot about the power of our aspirations. What hauls us to do anything, especially something worthwhile, that has meaning for us, but is also challenging, like coming to a retreat, even if it's just one full day of practice. It takes a lot of courage to do it. What calls us to this? What calls us? So I'm curious. What has called you to this practice, to being here this weekend? Just take a moment. Notice what images arise for you, what words, sensations in the body as you reflect on not just what brought you here to this retreat, but what are your aspirations for your life? Aspirations for practice. What is it that your heart, your mind longs to live into? And now if it feels organic to you, feel free to just name here in the hall. What is it that you long to live into? You can just do this popcorn style. What brought you here? What are your aspirations for your life? Practice. And we're among Dharma friends, so there's no need to be shy. I bet you might articulate your aspirations differently, but I'm sure they're very similar.
Depth.
Depth. Depth. Depth. Thank you. I long to live with, to be a safe space and a refuge for all of life.
Clarity and compassion.
Clarity and compassion. Beautiful. Depth, clarity, and compassion. Any other brave beings?
Presence.
Presence. Lovely. I know there's more because y'all here.
Community.
Community, connection, right? Relationship.
Peace.
Peace. Yes. peace. The Buddha said a lot about that. Now they're just coming. This is great. What else? What was that?
Sense of self.
Beautiful. Sense of self.
Truth.
Truth.
Ellen, my daughter.
Ellen, your daughter.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Perspective.
Perspective.
Patience,
Kanti Parmi.
Centered.
Strength. Any others?
Nothing left out.
Nothing left out.
Kindness.
Kindness.
Being content.
Being content.
Non-division.
Do we need that right now?
Embracing what is.
Embracing what is. I can't stop y'all.
Creativity.
And flexibility. These are so beautiful.
Ease.
Ease. Maybe this will be the talk for the whole night. Let's do this. We want to live into these beautiful, wholesome qualities. Ease. Embracing what is. Kindness. Being content. Non-division. Allow these qualities to land in your heart, to land in your body. Flexibility. Perspective. Patience. Creativity. Truth. Freedom. Community, peace, sense of self, presence, Ellen, depth, clarity. Compassion, strength, nothing left out. These aspirations, these longings, in my opinion, are an expression of what Gil Fronsdale calls the biological imperative for freedom. Gil's an insight teacher in our community. And this is what he says about this biological imperative that you've spoken to so directly. He says that somehow the depth, the core of what this Dharma practice is about, it's not up to you. Something's going to be working through you. And it's nothing mystical. It's not like coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart. The biological imperative for liberation. Just read that over and over again. Something's going to be working through you. It's nothing mystical. It's not coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart. the biological imperative for liberation. There's a deep, a biological imperative for freedom. But how do we live into that? So I was here on retreat. Joseph Goldstein was teaching. I think he was offering metta. It was the retreat right before COVID. It was circulating, but we hadn't shut down anything yet. So it was the February, right before we went into lockdown. It's a different time, right? Totally different time. So Joseph is here and he's talking about metta, and he says, you know, we could characterize practice as learning to love no matter what. I was really surprised at that characterization. That we could think of practice as learning to love no matter what. And this yogi raised their hand and they said, that's beautiful. But how do I do that? Such a beautiful question. And I think the person who asked this question, and I feel like this yogi asked it on behalf of all of us. I think it's a perennial question that we all have. How do we live into our aspirations of perspective and freedom and community and clarity and compassion and living for our dear ones and nothing left out, embracing what is? How do we live into that? I think she was aware, this yogi, I don't know how they identified, but this yogi, I think they were aware of the obstacles that can get in the way, or what seems to be in the way, of living into our aspirations. Because we are such soft, yes, we're strong and resilient, but we're also soft, vulnerable beings. We have these heart minds, these eyes and these ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, that are so sensitive. And they're meant to be sensitive. We're meant to know the world through attuning to and resonating with the world of sights and sounds and smells and tastes and sensations of the body and moods and emotions and thoughts, our own, that of others. And if the world of the senses was all pleasant, all pleasurable, all pleasing, this would be a heaven realm. But it's not. It's a dukkha realm. And we all know dukkha. The Buddha talked about it as unsatisfactoriness. Some people like to translate it as stress. We all know the stress of loss, of a body that's starting to age. We know the stress of sexism, of discrimination, class discrimination. We know the stress of sorrow and blame. We know the stress of living in a world that has way too many wars occurring. And we know it because it hits our very soft and sensitive hearts and bodies and nervous systems. And when we take in the world through the six senses, through the six sense gates, the sixth being the heart mind, it hurts sometimes. And when it hurts, there's another biological imperative that kicks in, and that's the biological imperative to avoid pain. And we all know the strategies to avoid pain, right? We bury our head in the sand. We brace in the body. We freeze the body. We live from the neck up. We pretend everything's okay. I have an uncle who's very fond of saying, it is what it is. And I can hear the resignation, the trying to distance himself from the difficulty and just say, like, you know, it doesn't affect me, it is what it is. But the truth is it does. It impacts all of us. When pain hits, we struggle with life, sometimes we get really aggressive and confront it, we try to control it, we try to will our way out of it, negotiate. And we want to avoid pain, and at the same time, we want to be free. This biological imperative to avoid pain and this biological imperative to live into our aspirations, this biological imperative for liberation, for freedom. And it can feel like these two biological imperatives are at cross purposes with each other. And this is what was so poignant about this yogi's question, right? She's saying, how do I live into this? It's as if this person was saying, I want to be free, but it's hard to be free considering everything a human heart and body is susceptible to. Right? Considering everything that a human heart and a body goes through in a lifetime. Did we think we would ever live through a global pandemic? Right. Centuries-old collective injustices, political dysfunction and division, loss of loved ones, deterioration of health. Right. But these biological imperatives to avoid pain and to live into freedom, they don't need to live in opposition of each other. They can actually fuel each other and support each other through wisdom and compassion, i.e. learning to love no matter what. Because learning to love no matter what is a potential of every human heart. It's a potential and it's actually the true nature of the heart when it's not occluded by the different strategies that I named and that we all know so personally. And we can grow into these aspirations using the biological imperative to avoid pain gradually. We do it gradually through wisdom, through mindfulness, this what you've been cultivating all day. This capacity to just know what's happening while it's happening from this non-judgmental, open, sometimes sati can feel quite warm, interested, alert, knowing presence. And we gradually grow into learning to love no matter what through encouragement, not making an enemy of our reactivity to avoid pain, which just arises because we just want to be safe. Right? We want our loved ones to be safe. We want to come by the basic necessities of life easily. We just want to be healthy and be able to care for ourselves, care for our loved ones, i.e. we just want to avoid pain. And then your activity comes. It's just an innocent movement of the heart. It's just an innocent movement of the heart. So there are two Brahmaviharas. I should explain Brahmaviharas. So Brahmaviharas, these four qualities of the heart. I know some of you are familiar with them. Some of you may not be. And they were actually around before the Buddha was born. So he came into the world, and the Brahmaviharas were already a part of the spiritual teachings. The unique contribution that the Buddha made to the Brahmaviharas is that he scooped them up, he gathered them up into this path of awakening. And he even had a name for them in the Pali. He characterized these four beautiful qualities of heart, of metta, which we practice this afternoon. You practice this afternoon with Roxanne. Compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. are all qualities that were afoot. And the Buddha characterized these four qualities as citta vimutti, a temporary liberation of mind. That when the heart is actually filled with these, like the genuine experience of loving kindness, and it can be so simple, it's just a mind that doesn't have any ill will in it. It's just friendly. Doesn't need to be intense. Doesn't need to be this grand experience, elevated experience. It's just this basic friendliness, basic human warmth. When compassion is present, the heart touching challenge and difficulty and pain and resonating with it, and then being moved to alleviate that pain if we can. If not, mitigating it. And sometimes the way that we mitigate or alleviate the pain is just simply bearing witness, accompanying someone through a challenge or accompanying ourselves through some difficulty. We can't change the situation, but we can actually decrease the distress by bearing witness, being with. A temporary liberation of mind when the heart is just resting in sympathetic joy and celebrating someone else's good fortune and their beautiful qualities. A temporary liberation of mind when equanimity is present and we're totally in touch with life, totally intimate and balanced. And we're not taking sides. We're not for or against anything. We're not leaning into the experience, wanting more of it, and we're not pushing it away. We're just balanced, steady. They are receiving the experience. And we're not broken by the challenges of life. And we're not elevated into some exuberant state over some pleasant experience. Life flows through us. And we're just steadily knowing it. And responding appropriately. So when there's a challenge or difficulty, compassion arises. When we're just being with another being. Or life here on the planet. Just friendliness. And we see someone's goodness and the heart is moved to celebrate. Joy, a little one taking their first steps. And there's just mudita that fills the heart. Temporary liberation of the mind. So out of these two, these four Brahma Viharas, the two that have been a real ballast for me in these 4 years have been compassion and equanimity. I've discovered before I can even genuinely live into like a genuine expression of compassion and equanimity, I have to have an honest, direct encounter with my reactivity, with the part of my heart mind that just wants to avoid pain and duck out. And sometimes that can feel counterintuitive, to have an honest, direct encounter with what the Buddha called dukkha, pain. Because sometimes we get caught in this thinking of like, been practicing for such and such for however long, and we get impatient with ourselves. We see ourselves still running certain patterns, still running like patterns of anxiety, afflictive mind states. As I was saying earlier, the heart matures on this path gradually. It's a gradual process. In fact, the Buddha characterized this path of awakening, our moving towards awakening, as a gradual path. He called it the gradual path. And our practice, there's a beautiful, beautiful image of the suttas. In the suttas, there's this, through the practice, we're actually slowly wearing away at these reflexive habits of wanting to avoid what's challenging, craving. There's a really beautiful wish I could recall exactly where it is. Beautiful passage. Or the Buddha likens a rope that's out in nature, the weather, and through time and weather, the rope is being worn away. And he likens that rope to our habits that keep us connected to suffering. That slowly the practice starts to wear away at that rope. And until we've completely uprooted greed, aversion, and delusion, our heart is completely liberated, we're going to go through cycles of reactivity. It's just inevitable. Especially when we don't feel we have the inner resources to meet the challenges and the situation and the difficulties of our times. So we don't need to make an enemy of our reactivity because, as I said, it just comes from this very innocent movement of the heart. We're just wanting to be safe and avoid pain. And our reactivity, just by virtue of bringing mindfulness to it and seeing it through a Dharma lens. I was just recently supporting a course with Venerable Analio. He's a monastic and a scholar of early Buddhism. He's leading a year-long course, and we just completed the second retreat. And he talked about seeing through the details of our experience. I thought it was a really interesting phrase, a way of looking at calling on the Dhamma as a support for us. So not getting caught up in the content of our experience, but starting to see through the details of it to the process nature, right? So just by virtue of bringing mindfulness to our reactivity and seeing through the content and the details to the process nature of it, we transform the reactivity and it actually becomes a gateway to developing our aspirations, living into our aspirations. So our reactivity, when we relate to it in an intelligent way, right, with mindfulness and the Dhamma, it becomes the means by which we cultivate beautiful, wholesome qualities that you all just named. Peace, perspective, community, right mindfulness, investigation, energy, truthfulness, generosity. Nothing left out. And these qualities carry us along on the path. They become supports for us moving towards freedom and liberation or whatever our aspirations or our longings are for our life and practice. So in my own practice, I've found that before I can even arouse compassion for myself or another person, before I can even stand equanimous amid the conditions of my life, I need to engage three fundamental practices. Patience, self-compassion, and then calling on my heart, calling on my imagination to really empathize with someone's circumstances through using my imagination in a, not a moral way, an ethical way. So let's just look at how patience can support us in being with the part of ourselves that just wants to avoid pain, and out of that comes reactivity. So I'm actually going to use an example of hatred. I'm going to continue to use it throughout this talk because we can be so intent on awakening and so intent on living into our aspirations that we shy away from some of these more afflictive, intense mind states because it's so antithetical to where we're heading, to our aspirations. And we can shy away from them, not want to see them, dress them up as something else. But the Buddha gives us really clear advice on this. So I want to use this afflictive heart-mind state of hatred as an example. So something happens. Samsara, dukkha, some experience comes through the sense gates, and some reactivity of hatred arises within the heart-mind. And we're just asked to bring mindfulness to that experience. This is hatred. And we just allow ourselves, can we actually allow ourselves to know it? And to actually be mindful of it. And sometimes the heart is like, no, can't. It's like, okay. In that instance, can you allow the, make space for the hatred to be there and the resistance to the hatred? Actually widen mindfulness to hold both. So we broaden mindfulness to be aware of the hatred itself, the resistance towards it. Or sometimes there's not even resistance, so we're just with this mind state. We just know it. Right? And this step of just recognizing whatever mind states are present, but just even hatred, just recognizing it, it's a foundational practice. It's a part of the four establishments of mindfulness. These four establishments of just being aware of the body, feeling tone, this basic movement of the heart that feels into experience like, oh, that's pleasant, that's unpleasant, that's neither, and neutral. Right? Third establishment of just knowing the mind state of hatred or some emotion. It could be positive, right? Can we actually know these moods and states that are flowing through the heart-mind, that are fueling our words and our actions? So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. The Buddha actually describes how we practice with some of these states, especially the state of hatred. Said, and how does one abide contemplating mind as mind? How does one abide contemplating a mind state as a mind state? And he says, here one understands a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. Right? So we're just recognizing the mind state. And we're recognizing that these mind states actually shape how we see the world, how we experience the world. The Buddha knew this over 2,700 years ago. He knew what Pali Vegal calls state creates story. I remember I just woke up one morning quite just pained. I was just in pain. I didn't recognize the mind state. So I was going about my morning, getting in my car, I'm at a stop sign. And there's a huge truck next to me. And my window was rolled down. And as the driver hit the gas, the engine made this like roaring sound that the engine revved. And it just moved into my body. And it felt, there was just this physical and psychic pain. And there was this eruption of anger. I started violently rolling up the window, and then mindfulness appeared in that moment. Very grateful. It's like, oh, you're reacting to the sound with all of this anger because you've been in a foul mood all morning and you haven't recognized it. Here's this mood that's shaping how you're experiencing the sound. Another example, I was working at Spirit Rock. This was before I started teaching. I was working at Spirit Rock in the family program. Had a migraine, an intense, actually, you don't need to qualify migraines, do you? They're all intense and horrible. So It was migraine. It's the end of the day, and all of the volunteers are up in the upper walking hall, and they're just talking about their just snapshots of the day of working with children. So much sweetness. And by the end, very distinct memory of this intense migraine. Don't need to qualify it, sweetie. It's a migraine. And I was so happy. I wasn't in anguish or in agony around this migraine. There was just happiness in the stream of the mind. Again, state creates story. It shapes how we experience the world. And if we're not aware that these moods and emotions are actually coloring how we hear our partner or how we take in the news, we will come to some basic assumptions about the world that may or may not actually be true. Right? So this third establishment, it's profound. It's simple. We just know a mind affected by greed or happiness or hatred as a mind affected by greed, joy, happiness, hatred. We just simply know it. Because most of the time, we're not recognizing these mind states and how they're impacting and influencing our words and the actions that we take. And this gets built on in the third establishment of mindfulness, the fourth establishment of mindfulness. So the third, we're simply recognizing mind states, mindful of them. And then in the fourth establishment, we're not only recognizing the states, but we're seeing, okay, what are some of the conditions that led to this state? I woke up in the foul mood. Oh, this happiness is conditioned. I'm here in this retreat setting around all these beautiful volunteers doing this beautiful, wholesome work. They're naming these beautiful moments, and my heart is resonating with that. Ah, this happiness is conditioned. It's shaped by the conditions and the circumstances that we find ourselves in. The fourth establishment, we really start to feel into what are the conditions that give rise to some of these states. It's one way of characterizing the fourth establishment. So this, how does one abide contemplating mind as mind? Here one understands a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. This is our birthright. This is our birthright. The Buddha called the third establishment of mind, actually he called all four establishments of mindfulness, our ancestral land, our native land. These four establishments of the body, feeling, tone, mind, dhammas. You could characterize dhammas, this fourth establishment, as relating to our experiences with wise effort and mindfulness, in such a way that we end up moving away from suffering and towards awakening. Yeah. The Buddha called these four establishments our ancestral land. Gil Fronsdale likes to translate it as our native land. Venerable Inalio likes to use the phrase our home turf. I love that. The body, feeling tone, the heart-mind, various states that arise within the heart-mind, these dhammas are our home turf. Our home turf. And usually in relationship to our home turf, body, feelings, mind states, dhammas, we're usually caught up in our ideas, our views, our opinions about them. And the Buddha was saying, look, in relationship to the first establishment, in relationship to your body, don't get caught up in your ideas about the body, your wishes for the body, your the ways that we've been acculturated to relate to our bodies or relate to the bodies of others. He's saying, bring mindfulness to this first establishment. Use it as a means to arouse mindfulness. And when you arouse that mindfulness, use that mindfulness as a lens to actually understand and get to know the nature of the body. What's the true nature of the body? Instead of getting caught up in skin color or gender or my body's this and I wish it were that, instead of like letting all of that go, it says, let all that mess go. Really use sati, mindfulness, to understand the nature of the body. And what's the nature of the body? It has these different parts. It's not inherently sexually attractive. When I heard this, I was like, what? Then he has us, Roxanne mentioned this in today's, gosh, that seems so long ago this morning, that guided meditation you offered. She mentioned the practice of the 32 parts. Sometimes it's 33 if you include the brain. These 32 parts. And you start to know the hair and bones and nails and teeth and flesh and some other parts of the body that aren't as appealing. And then parts of the body that are pretty neutral. And you recognize that the body is actually neither attractive or unattractive. It just is. It just is. And another basic practice of this first establishment, bringing mindfulness to the body, and we start to drop into its elemental experience. And we were playing with this morning, being aware of temperature, whether the hands are cold or warm, movement in the body, tingling, pulsing, the weight of the body, being aware of a lightness in the shoulders or the heaviness of your sitting base, right? And you start to recognize, this body is an elemental process that I don't have any control over. I have some influence. I can't control this body. Not self. This body's not self. And then he rounds out our contemplation of the body through bringing in death contemplation. So when I heard depth earlier today, I thought you were referring to that death. And we recognize that this body, time limited, won't always be here. And this, when we relate to it wisely, can support us in, how do I want to live? I ain't got much time. How do I want to spend my time? And we don't know when death is going to come. We don't know when death comes knocking. Can we live with that as a reality? Maybe some of you know that the monastic Venerable Anālio, in order to keep death, this contemplation, at the forefront of his heart and his mind, he has a skeleton in his little kuti, in the corner of his little kuti, and he sleeps in a coffin. This is someone who really takes this contemplation to heart. And he says it's his favorite contemplation. I asked him, why? And he said, it just clarified my values. I got really clear about how I wanted to live my life and how I wanted to spend my time. And this is a being who has dedicated himself to being in retreat 5 months at it, or, well, he's in retreat 6 days a week. He comes out to do scholarship, checks some emails, and he goes back into retreat for 6 days. That's when he's out of retreat, when he's in his months of retreat. He's in for like 5 months. He'll come out again, and then he's in for another 5 months. What would it be like if we walked with death as our companion? not to be afraid of our death, but to be reminded we don't have as much time as we think we do. We don't know when death is coming. How do we want to live? How do we want to treat each other? How do we want to treat ourselves? So we bring mindfulness to these establishments, this first establishment of the body, all four establishments. And we have an honest, direct encounter with the body, the feeling tone, the mind states, the dhammas, resting in our home turf, resting in our ancestral domain. And by virtue of doing that, we come into, I think, what the Buddha calls our inheritance. Our birthright, that he describes at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. Actually, Roxanne alluded to this in the morning instructions. He says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four Satipatthanas. This is a possibility for our heart, freedom from lamentation, sorrow, pain, dukkha. So when I say being with our reactivity, learning to be with it in an intelligent way, I'm not being poetic. The Buddha was for real. Third establishment of mindfulness. Can lean in and actually know these states without being driven by them. Right? And this is where we bring in patience. Right? And patience for me is this, to me it feels like the training ground of equanimity. Right? We're with these mind states that are really challenging, utterly painful. Indignation, hatred, and we call on patience. Kanti Parami, I was so happy to hear this as an aspiration. Kanti Parami, patience that actually can be with and know the discomfort, the ouch of some of these afflictive mind states without letting them breach the boundaries of our heart. Moving into our words and our actions. So we know these states and we make a commitment to know them while also living into our commitment to live ethically, right? Run over time. And there's so much more to share. I'll just share this one piece around compassion. Right? So we're coming from actually learning how to integrate our biological imperative to avoid pain as a support for living into this biological imperative for freedom. Right? Support for that is living with compassion and equanimity. But before we can even do that, we need to have an honest encounter with the dukkha of our lives, the pain and the challenges of our lives. The support for that is third establishment of mindfulness. Other is patience. As we're with hatred or indignation or whatever's arising for us, we're aware of it without acting out on it. That's the patience. And we feel the ouch of it, the pain of it. And this is where the self-compassion comes in. And the question sometimes arises, well, isn't self-compassion just self-indulgence? I really love what Kristen Neff says. She's a professor of educational psychology and a researcher, and she came up with this practice of self-compassion. It has three steps in it. Self-compassion break. And this is what she says, and I love it. She says, self-compassion, true self-compassion, is not the same as being easy on ourselves. It's a way of nurturing ourselves so that we can reach our full potential. It's a way of nurturing ourselves so that we can reach our full potential. Again, the Buddha knew this over 2,700 years ago, but now we have research, neurobiology, letting us know that when we meet ourselves and other people with judgment, the subcortical region of the brain starts to fire, right? Thinks there's trouble and difficulty. The brain gets unintegrated, i.e. the parts of the brain aren't speaking to each other. And we react out of that disintegration. But when we bring in compassion, there are these chemicals called GABA chemicals. I don't know what that stands for. They're released into the subcortical region of the brain. And it's been characterized as when it gets released, this compassion practice that supports the flow of GABA moving into the subcortical region when there's reactivity. It's characterized as, shh, it's okay. Calming that subcortical region of the brain with compassion. It's okay. And we know this when we practice compassion. Hand on the heart, hand on the belly. And we feel our own soothing presence, our own tenderness. The Buddha didn't need neuroscience to tell him this. And neither do we. We can just trust the practice. Trust the practice of patience, third establishment of mindfulness, compassion, to help us actually live into our aspirations that you so beautifully named. Let's end the evening where we started. Ease. Nothing left out. Strength, clarity, compassion, depth, Ellen, presence, sense of self, freedom and peace, truth, community, creativity, patience, perspective, flexibility, non-divisiveness, centered, kindness, being content, embracing what is. So let's just sit and let the words settle. That somehow the depth, the core of what this Dhamma practice is about, it's not up to you. Something's going to be working through you. And it's nothing mystical. It's not like coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart. The biological imperative for liberation. Thank you for your care, your very kind attention. We have a period of walking till about 9 o'clock, and then we'll come back here for our last sit together and some chanting. I hope to see you there.